Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the April 21st issue of People Magazine, as well as the April edition of Women's Health. A couple of the articles I will be sharing with you today include Remembering a Rebel and Here's to Future You. Val Kilmer, 1959 to 2025. Remembering a Rebel. The Top Gun actor reached the height of Hollywood stardom, but he was a true original who treasured his own indomitable spirit above fame. By Tom Gliotto from People Magazine. Reporting for his first professional acting job at age 13, Val Kilmer already knew one thing. He would refuse to compromise his artist's soul, and certainly not for a cheeseburger ad, especially when it wasn't even a good cheeseburger. "The thing tasted like cardboard," he wrote in his 2020 memoir, I'm Your Huckleberry. "The director kept telling me to put my heart into it. I couldn't. I walked off the set and never appeared in the commercial and never got paid." Even though he balked at having to wade into what he referred to as a sea of Hollywood fluff, Kilmer, who died from pneumonia at age 65 in L.A. on April 1st, was a Hollywood star and an irresistible sex symbol. The camera loved the flinty angularity of his jaw, the slope of his nose, the perfect bow shape of his upper lip. In the 1980s and 90s, he gave iconic performances as Tom Cruise's cocky rival, Iceman, in Top Gun, 1986, the Caped Crusader in Batman Forever, 1995, and Jim Morrison in The Doors, 1991. He didn't always enjoy the ride. "Fame was not my priority," he said, and he earned a reputation for being a challenge on set. Batman director Joel Schumacher described him as the most psychologically troubled human being I've ever worked with. Then, around 2015, when he was in his mid-50s, throat cancer robbed him of his voice. Yet, he made a courageous and touching return in 2022's Top Gun Maverick. "Tom wouldn't make Maverick without him," says producer Jerry Bruckheimer. "He knew how important Val was." The public response to his five-minute scene with Cruise, in which his few whispered lines of dialogue were enhanced by software, was deeply heartening to Kilmer. He seemed ready for a comeback, if on his own idiosyncratic terms. "My dream," he told the Los Angeles Times, "is to play Frankenstein with Werner Herzog directing." Maverick, however, would be the end of his extraordinary career, although he made a valiant retrospective 2021 documentary, Val, with his son Jack, 29, reading the narration. "We are so proud of him and honored to see his legacy celebrated. Jack and sister Mercedes, 33, whom Kilmer shared with actress Joanne Wally, 63, his ex-wife, said in a statement after his death. Another emotional tribute was paid, not surprisingly, by Cruise. At the CinemaCon convention in Las Vegas on April 3rd, the star asked for a moment of silence. "I really can't tell you how much I admired his work," Cruise said, how much I thought of him as a human being. Kilmer considered Cruz a friend. They exchanged holiday gifts. Even if at times he'd been known to roll his eyes at Cruz's steely command of his own career. Asked once if he'd ever made jokes about the superstar, Kilmer answered, "You can't make fun of Tom Cruise. Poor thing." But that was Kilmer, unpredictable, ungovernable, never boring. Cher, one of his most famous lovers, once described him to people as really thrilling and funny and up for crazy things. When Kilmer auditioned to play an American rocker behind the Iron Curtain in 1984's Top Secret, the comedy that made him a star, he performed an impromptu Elvis impersonation that was incredible, says co-director David Zucker. During the filming of the 1993 Western Tombstone, writer Kevin Jarre recalled, he and Kilmer were deep in conversation about the actor's character, Doc Holliday, when a stand-in brought over a very colorful sort of locust and said, "Look what I found." Val, without saying a word, grabbed the locust from the guy and ate it. And it was big. As a kid in Los Angeles's Chatsworth neighborhood, growing up on a property that had once belonged to cowboy star Roy Rogers, Kilmer began studying acting in grammar school, already dreaming of emulating Hollywood's eccentric, nonpareil Marlon Brando. He was the son of Eugene Kilmer, a real estate developer, and homemaker Gladys, whom Kilmer described as lovely but remote, as enigmatic to me as Ingrid Bergman. The middle of three boys, he shared an artistic sensibility with younger brother Wesley, although he claimed that Wesley was the genius. With a precocious talent for directing, he cast Val in home movies. At Chatsworth High, Kilmer was a theater standout whose classmates included Mare Winningham, his first girlfriend. One of the youngest students ever admitted to the Juilliard School, Kilmer was just heading off to New York City to start classes when he learned that Wesley, who had epilepsy, had died back home. He suffered a seizure in a jacuzzi and drowned at the age of 15. The family's Christian Science faith helped Kilmer go on, as it would years later when cancer struck, but Wesley's death never stopped haunting him. "I want my brother alive," he wrote in his memoir, "physically, not just spiritually." After Juilliard, Kilmer's path to success was relatively smooth. He had hits with Top Secret and another silly comedy, Real Genius, 1985, then became a major star in the blockbuster Top Gun. He always claimed he hadn't even wanted to audition, "but when I finally saw the film for the first time, I jumped up after the first 5 minutes and yelled, 'This is a hit.'" His next hit, the fantasy adventure Willow, introduced him to British actress Wally, his co-star, whom he wed in 1988. It was his only marriage in a long line of relationships and friendships with glamorous stars, including Daryl Hannah, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Cindy Crawford. He once quipped, "I wish I'd been as dedicated to my career as I was to women." Over the next decade, Kilmer was in his prime. For The Doors, he spent a year honing his startling physical closeness to doomed rocker Morrison. Batman Forever was another smash, although he hated being trapped in that heavy molded costume. It was frustrating, he said, until I realized that my role in the film was just to show up and stand where I was told to. Kilmer and Wally split in 1995, the same year the LA crime classic Heat, his last great film, was released. After that, his roles lost some glimmer. The 1996 horror film, The Island of Dr. Moreau, was a legendary disaster, even though it paired Kilmer with his idol Brando. Brando got, according to Batman director Schumacher, Brando got so annoyed with Kilmer that he scolded him. "Young man, don't confuse your ego with the size of your salary, ever." Having a lone wolf reputation, he came to realize, had its drawbacks. "It's a very social business," he told The Hollywood Reporter. "I never tried to be involved in the community." As his leading man career faded, he devoted more time to his painting hobby and to touring in a cherished project, a one-man show about Mark Twain. About 10 years ago, after ignoring a lump in his throat that made swallowing difficult, he awoke in bed vomiting blood. Diagnosed with throat cancer, he underwent chemotherapy and radiation that prolonged his life, but left him unable to eat or speak except through a tracheostomy hole. "Sometimes I feel so low, and I have the blues really, really hard," he told People in 2021. But he rallied thanks to his faith and the support of his kids. "He can't be stopped," Jack told People. "He wants to go out there and be the best he can be." Kilmer was never better than in Maverick. He and Cruise had both teared up by the end of their scene. "It was extremely emotional," says Bruckheimer. Looking back on the franchise's success, Kilmer may have begun to reassess his feelings about that sea of fluff. "I was too serious," he told The Hollywood Reporter. He even confessed that he'd have appreciated more recognition. With 5 MTV Award nominations and 4 Razzie nominations, but no Oscar nods, he was right to feel overlooked. "I would like to have more Oscars than anybody," he said. "Meryl Streep must feel pretty good, you know? It's about being loved." Bon Voyage Val, Hollywood peers pay tribute. Michelle Monaghan. "Kilmer was a rebellious and radical gent," said his co-star in 2005's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Jim Carrey. "The actor, the Riddler, to Kilmer's caped crusader in Batman Forever, called him a generational talent." Nicolas Cage. "A genius actor," said Kilmer's co-star in 2009's Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call. "I admired his commitment." Ron Howard. "Kilmer's art wasn't just in his acting," said the Willow director, "but also in the way he lived. Bon voyage, Val." Josh Brolin. "You were a smart, challenging, brave, uber-creative firecracker," said his friend. Hilary Burton. "She said he made her feel secure when they filmed 2010's Bloodworth. I hope every young actor has a Val in their life." His most famous loves. Cher. Kilmer and Cher dated in the early 80s and stayed friends. Their pet names for each other? Valis Maximus and Charis Reprimandus. Cindy Crawford. He and the supermodel were together for 2 years. A smart girl with a great sense of humor, he later said. A fantastic cook, too. Daryl Hannah. Kilmer's breakup with his hard cash co-star in 2003 devastated him. Lord knows I've suffered heartache with women, he wrote, but Daryl was by far the most painful of all. The Reluctant Movie Idol. Top Secret, 1984. He would clown around, but he rehearsed diligently, says co-director David Zucker. Willow, 1988. Kilmer wrote that he was initially ashamed of the fantasy, now a family classic. The Doors, 1991. I primarily saw myself playing a poet, he said of his acclaimed performance as Jim Morrison. Batman Forever. Playing the comic book hero with Nicole Kidman, he fought with director Joel Schumacher, who later said he was fabulous. Tombstone, 1993. To heighten the realism of his death scene as Doc Holliday, Kilmer had the crew fill his bed with ice. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Robert Downey Jr. affectionately described Kilmer as chronically eccentric. Top Gun and Top Gun Maverick. I can't believe how kind the whole world has been, he said of his reunion with Tom Cruise in the sequel. I get hundreds of fan letters every week. It's very humbling. With additional reporting by Shereya Drury, this has been Val Kilmer, 1959 to 2025, Remembering a Rebel, from People. Bravo's Brittany Cartwright. My son is autistic and he's incredible. After documenting her son Cruz's challenges with speech on The Valley, the reality star is opening up about his diagnosis and her ongoing struggles with ex Jax Taylor. By Brianne Tracy, photographs by Nolwenn Cifuentes. This is from People magazine. Sitting in the foyer of her Los Angeles home in mid-February, Brittany Cartwright recalls a recent moment with her 3-year-old son, Cruz, that almost brought her to tears. He was in his car seat, and all of a sudden he goes, "Mommy, I want to get out," plain as day, says the reality star 36. I could have cried because hearing him say a full sentence was heartbreaking in the best way. Fans of Bravo's The Valley will recognize how big of a milestone this was for Cruz, whose struggles with speech were documented in the first season of the hit reality show last year. His journey, as well as Cartwright's and her ex, Jax Taylor's search for answers about their son, continues in season 2, premiering April 15th. Since filming wrapped before they received the official diagnosis from Cruz's developmental pediatrician last fall, Cartwright is sharing for the first time publicly that her son, who turned 4 on April 12th, is autistic and has limited speech. On the show, it's obvious that he's nonverbal, and I wanted to be able to talk about this on my own terms instead of having social media people trying to diagnose him. My son is autistic and he's incredible. I'm his voice now. I'm his warrior now. Since learning Cruz's diagnosis, the Kentucky native, who has primary physical custody of her son, has been adjusting to a different normal. "This is a whole new life for me," she says. "I don't have any close friends that live near me that have kids with autism, so I don't really have anybody that can relate to what I'm going through. They're all super supportive, of course, but there's just a lot of ins and outs that a lot of people don't really understand." Making things more complicated is having to navigate her relationship with her ex, who made headlines in March for admitting his struggle with cocaine addiction over the past 20 years. Cartwright and Taylor, 45, separated after 10 years in February 2024, and Cartwright filed for divorce in August. "Going through this divorce and everything has really made me so much stronger," she says. "At the end of the day, everything I'm doing is because of my son." Cartwright's path to reality TV began in 2015 when she met Taylor, already 2 years into his Vanderpump Rules stardom, at a bar in Las Vegas. She moved from Kentucky to LA to be with him and joined season 4 of the show. The couple, who also had a 2017 spinoff, Jax and Brittany Take Kentucky, weathered all their biggest ups and downs, including Taylor's 2017 affair with Vanderpump castmate Faith Stowers, on camera until their exit from the show in 2020. "I went through a lot of things on that show that I didn't want to watch back," Cartwright says. The brightest point in Cartwright's relationship with Taylor came in 2021, 2 years after their wedding, when they welcomed Cruz. "He was so beautiful from the start," she says. "He was so healthy. Everything was perfect." As Cruz grew, he quickly checked off developmental milestones. He was crawling, walking, rolling over, all that stuff before he was even supposed to. Then, as his second birthday approached, Cruz stopped talking almost completely. She enrolled him in speech therapy right away and decided to show some of the sessions on the Valley in hopes of helping other parents. "I try to remember that people can relate to this. I'm not the only one going through this. It's nothing to be ashamed or embarrassed about." When Cartwright finally received Cruz's diagnosis of autism, she was expecting it. "But of course, when you get it, it just made everything real," she says. "Our life is going to look a little bit different, but I feel like I was meant to be his mom." Though Cruz is mostly nonverbal, Cartwright says he will sporadically say different words, like mommy. "It can be difficult because I've never heard him say, 'I love you,'" she says. "But he is so loving, and he shows me he loves me every single day." I think a lot of times with nonverbal children, people don't think that they understand what's going on, or they think they're not very smart. And that's just not true. Cruz is very smart. At preschool, Cruz has a therapeutic companion who joins him, and he continues to do speech and occupational therapy several times a week. At home, he has a sensory room fitted with a trampoline and lights to help him regulate when he's overstimulated. He also loves swimming in the pool and swinging on the swing set in their backyard. Right now is the time he's building his brain, so we're setting the building blocks, she says. "I'm just trying to do everything I possibly can to help him live the happiest life ever, and I feel very blessed that I'm able to give him everything he needs. That's why I want to help as many mothers as I can." She has the same goals in sharing the recent trials in her relationship with Taylor. "If I can help one woman get out of a toxic relationship, then I have won," she says. "I get a lot of hate online, like, She knew what she was getting into. But I was blinded by love. The point is that I did leave him. Leading up to their separation, Cartwright said she'd had enough of Taylor's comedowns related to his substance abuse issues. He was just so aggressive and horrible to me, yelling at me in front of our son, she says. After they split, he just spiraled out of control, she says. 5 months into their separation, Taylor checked himself into an inpatient facility for mental health treatment. During that time, Cartwright filed her divorce paperwork. I realized I have to do this now, before he gets out and has the chance to pull me back in, she says. Her relationship with Taylor, who said in March that he's sober, remains touch and go. He's done so much damage, and me and Cruz weren't enough for him to get help for a very long time, she says. I want his dad to be in his life, but it's really just hard when you can't trust somebody. It's going to take me a long time to regain trust in him. I can just hope and pray that one day he will completely knock this, because I'm not sure yet. With everything going on, Cartwright, who recently took over the podcast she previously shared with Taylor, When Reality Hits, admits she hasn't had much time for herself. I feel like I lost my sparkle, and I'm working really hard to get my sparkle back, she says. That's what this whole new journey is about. She's in no rush to enter a new romantic relationship, but Mama is ready to date, she says with a laugh. Bravo, give me a dating show. I deserve to have butterflies again. In the meantime, she's relishing every moment with Cruz. I'm just going to keep pushing forward and being a strong mama bear, she says. I'm so excited to see what my future holds. This has been Bravo's Brittany Cartwright. My son is autistic and he's incredible. From People Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Here's to future you, the next 20 years. What will health and wellness look like in 2045? Experts share their hopes, fears, and trend predictions for the two decades ahead. By Anna Medeiros from Women's Health. The year is 2045. Perhaps that makes you middle-aged, but people aren't calling it that name anymore. Maybe we're measuring age internally, assessing your biological age based on the vitality of your cells, for example, not the number of candles on your birthday cake. Or we're gauging age by health span, years feeling fully alive, and not lifespan, years being alive. In a particularly gracious version of this future world, aging is supported by healthcare professionals who take and treat women's pain seriously. While women outlive men by an average of 5.5 years, they tend to spend more of their lives in chronic pain, often as a result of age-related conditions, such as osteoarthritis. And when it comes to menopause, future doctors will, we hope, regularly and proactively offer hormone therapy and other yet-to-be-invented treatments, like implantable devices that detect and dispense said hormones. A future in which women have the knowledge and tools to continue living their best lives well into their 60s, 70s, and beyond? That would be my wildest dream, says OBGYN Jessica Shepherd, MD, author of Generation M, living well in perimenopause and menopause. A lot of that has to do with how we treat ourselves, emotionally, nutrition, exercise, but also hormone replacement therapy, because it gives you the ability to have that longevity. Your body can thrive on it. Of course, 2045 could look a lot more dire for women in the U.S. The climate crisis, a warming world, disproportionately affects women's health, linking to issues such as preterm birth and worsened menopausal symptoms. Stymied medical research. In early 2025, grant and funding freezes halted essential healthcare research on things like endometriosis and cancer disparities, and reduced bodily autonomy. 19 states have a full ban on or limited access to abortion since Roe v. Wade was overturned, will remain essential issues that affect our overall well-being. But let's get to the good shifts that experts are excited about. Number one, precision care will transform your health. Here comes personalized everything, down to skincare salves formulated from a pinprick. Glenicia Noseworthy, MD, an internal medicine and aesthetic physician in New York City, is already offering her patients such solutions. Think injections of your own blood platelets instead of synthetic fillers. In fact, she coined the term beauty hacking to describe using your own biology and genetics to glow up without going under the knife. And she expects this practice to become only more widespread. If we are doing the proper blood work and realizing, okay, this is what your skin is lacking at this particular moment, we can customize your skincare to optimize you versus just selling you a generic line, she says. Psychiatrist Jessie Gold, MD, Chief Wellness Officer for the University of Tennessee System, has a related vision for the future of mental health. Instead of the largely trial and error approach of current depression treatments, she's eager to more definitively prescribe meds tailored to people's biology, history, and other characteristics. As it stands today, antidepressants only work the first try on about a third of patients. A little bit less darts and a little more precision would be very helpful, she notes. Your personal wellness routine and healthcare choices will likely be more tailored to your unique needs, too. Maybe that means structuring workouts around hormonal fluctuations, or taking supplements designed for your body, or using AI tools to make more informed decisions about cancer screenings. Machine learning could help you avoid unnecessary invasive treatments, like a painful colposcopy following an abnormal pap smear, by more accurately identifying the type of HPV present and its likelihood of developing into cancer. That's not to say healthcare in the future will be automated and cold. Doctors are focused on keeping people at the heart of medicine, whether you're seeing a doctor virtually, chatting with a bot about meds, or hanging in an office designed for comfort, not sterility. Think spa-like waiting rooms and sleeker specula. I hope that we can embrace technology and AI, but not lose the art of medicine, which is that personalized touch, says Women's Health Advisor Navya Mysore, MD, a primary care physician in New York City. That compassionate care, the ability to listen to someone, to hold their hand while they're going through something challenging, is so important. Number two, buckle up. GLP-1s are here to stay. It feels as if diabetes and weight loss drugs such as Ozempic and Wegovy are already everywhere right now. But by 2030, nearly 1 in 10 people are expected to be on a GLP-1. The injectable meds, which suppress appetite and lead people to lose an average of 15 to 25% of their body weight, are already influencing portion sizes, disrupting relationships, and infiltrating gym culture. Where will that put us in 20 years? Among other unknowns, the drugs could spike rates of injury and bone loss in women who aren't incorporating sufficient weight training and protein intake into their lifestyles, says Los Angeles-based celebrity trainer Jen Widerstrom. You're going to see a slew of problems like malnourishment and osteopenia and injuries cropping up, Widerstrom says. She's a proponent of the drugs in the right candidates with support, and she's also concerned about their broader influence. Some reports show that nearly 80% of 17-year-old girls say they're unhappy with their bodies, and roughly 1 in 10 adolescent girls say they've used non-prescription weight loss pills, including natural alternatives to Ozempic. On the other hand, the drug's widespread use could help drive down rates of obesity-related illnesses, such as heart disease and diabetes. They could be repurposed to treat substance use disorders and even behavioral addictions, such as gambling. For now, many doctors feel strongly that these drugs are a positive, revolutionary treatment for obesity at a time when 3 in 4 people are overweight or obese in the U.S. as of 2021 data. Number three, pay attention to policy and politics. They'll shape your situation. Experts are focused more broadly on how the federal government's priorities over the next 4 years are going to mold the future of women's health. The fate of the White House Initiative on Women's Health Research is murky. The webpage itself has been archived. And the dangerous consequences of the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022, which had previously granted women the right to an abortion, continue to reverberate. One 2024 investigation suggests that pregnant women in states with abortion bans are at higher risk of dying from preventable causes, including hemorrhages and fatal infections. Other data shows strain on the already burdened foster care system and exacerbated racial and socioeconomic disparities resulting from women forced to deliver babies that they can't support. Also frightening is the current disregard for investment in women's health. As it stands, just 4% of biopharma investments go to female-specific conditions. And beyond cancer, it's just 1%. And only 10.7% of the 2023 National Institutes of Health budget went to women's health research. And now that overall budget is facing major cuts. Innovative clinicians, entrepreneurs, private companies, and charitable foundations will need to step in, and some already have. scientists and researchers worked to save essential data from government health databases before it disappeared. And femtech startups are continuing to push forward with new funding from investors. We need to be a little bit more creative working within the system to be able to still push for change and progress, Dr. Mysore says. Number four, we will lift heavy and lift often. Over the past few decades, we've changed our relationship with exercise, ditching a singular focus on all cardio workouts to mix in strength training, trading out our little pink girl dumbbells for heavy as heck kettlebells, dumbbells, and barbells. But it's not about aesthetics this time around. Muscle health is finally a bigger focus for women of all ages. FYI, muscle mass can impact our metabolism, mobility, risk of chronic illness, brain health, and longevity. We're beginning to see the convergence of this concept of muscle being an organ system that is just as important as the heart, the lungs, the endocrine system, says women's health advisor Gabrielle Lyon-Dio. Women are turning toward muscle as their North Star. It was never like that before. The hope is that more women will come to understand the importance of muscle mass and curate workouts that celebrate their bodies, build their strength, and support their health. Number five, you will use your voice for change. Women can't sit back either. Not that we will or have been, but we are learning to get even more comfortable asking for what we need. There's a lot more women wanting to know more about themselves, as opposed to just going to a clinician, getting the recommendations, and taking the recommendations, says Umo Callens, RDN, a sports performance and wellness dietitian in Oklahoma. Increasingly, a lot of that knowledge is being shared or discovered online. TikTokers detail their excruciating IUD insertions and pave the way for the CDC to update its guidelines for physicians performing the procedures. And hundreds of thousands of people with poorly understood conditions pass along advice and offer support. Of course, this has its downsides, from companies peddling unregulated supplements to influencers without any credentials positioning themselves as experts. That's why it's critical to have an actual healthcare professional like a PCP or OBGYN in your corner. Number six, social connection will be key. Similarly, Dr. Mysore suggests turning to your own family, not just your Insta family, for connection and to better understand what might be normal or not for your body. Ask your mom about her postpartum experience or about menopause. What was that like for her? Talk to your aunt, talk to your grandmother, talk to your cousin, Dr. Mysore says. The more we talk to each other, the more we can empower ourselves. Widerstrom echoes that sentiment. She's witnessing more women who, in a healthy response to the current loneliness epidemic, are appreciating their social ties in real life in whole new ways. After her popular women's lifting class, for example, participants get coffee together. There is an aspect of social health that is going to be on the rise, says Widerstrom, and frankly, needs to be on the rise. Quick stats. A few educated guesses and science-backed digits from the research world. 1 in 10. By 2030, this many people are expected to be taking a GLP-1 medication. 4%. Currently, only 4% of biopharma investments go to female-specific conditions. 2 or 3 times. Women who do strength training 2 or 3 times a week will live longer than those who do none, per a study. You've been listening to Here's to Future You, the Next 20 Years, from Women's Health Magazine. Angelica Houston, Love, Healing After Cancer and Her Iconic Career. The Hollywood legend opens up for the first time about the private struggles she's faced in recent years and how she found joy. You Have to Remember to Laugh, by Breanne Tracy from People Magazine. Angelica Houston has held many titles throughout her nearly 6-decade career. Hollywood royalty, Oscar winner, Adam's Family matriarch. Her latest? Donkey advocate, she says in her signature purr over the phone from her ranch near the Sierra Nevada mountain range in California. There are several groups here who look after wild donkeys, and I'm one of them. Donkeys are not the showiest, but they're some of the sweetest animals I've ever met. I think they could always use more publicity. Houston, 73, has been living full-time at her ranch since January, when she evacuated her Los Angeles home amid the wildfires. It turned out to be okay, but it's taken this long to remediate because I had damage and several windows blown out, she says. Not terrible, but significant. While fleeing the fires with her housekeeper and pets, Houston was surprised to receive a call from her ex, Jack Nicholson, 87, whom she dated on and off from 1973 to 1990, asking if she was okay and if she needed a place to stay. It was heartbreakingly sweet, she says. I've gone back over it several times in my head, and I think next time I'd accept the invitation. After a few difficult years, Houston is holding tight to the relationships she cherishes most. In 2008, she lost her husband of 16 years, sculptor Robert Graham. Then, shortly after the premiere of her film, John Wick Chapter 3, Parabellum, in 2019, she received a cancer diagnosis, something she's never spoken about publicly before. That was a very serious moment for me, she says. It made me conscious of places I shouldn't go. One of those places was taking life too seriously and not being able to rejoice in what I do have. Now, 4 years cancer-free, Houston, who next appears in BritBox's limited series, Agatha Christie's Towards Zero, is reflecting on her legendary life and career. I've had more than my share of good luck, she says. I have a beautiful life. Born in Los Angeles to actor and director John Houston and prima ballerina and model Enrica Somo, Houston, who moved with her parents to Ireland when she was 2 to escape the McCarthy witch hunts in the U.S., knew from a young age she was destined for a career in the arts. I didn't really have much of a choice, says Houston, whose paternal grandfather is the actor Walter Houston. My family is so embroiled in movies. I don't know how we would disembroil. We all were very influenced by my father, and my mother was also theatrical and had great taste, so it seemed like a natural thing. I think something very negative would have had to happen for me to not be involved in film. So if people want to talk about her Nepo baby status, so be it. I think I did well, she says matter-of-factly. While Houston certainly has the accolades to prove it, her career got off to a rocky start. She was 16 when she was cast in her screen debut in her father's 1969 film, A Walk with Love and Death, shot before her mother's 1969 death in a car accident in France. A moment, she says, changed me forever. After her performance received negative reviews, she decided to shift her focus to modeling. She walked runways for designers like Halston and Valentino, and she also caught the attention of photographer Bob Richardson, whom she dated for 4 years. Their relationship began when Houston was around 18 and Richardson 41. He was definitely difficult, Houston says. He was also a genius, which unfortunately is something that often goes hand in hand with difficult. A month after she broke up with Richardson in 1973, Houston and Nicholson met Nicholson at a party at his home in L.A. and moved back to the city to give acting another shot. In 1985, Houston's father cast her as mafia daughter May Rose in his film Prizzi's Honor, also starring Nicholson. The combination of Jack and my father made it really significant and important, Houston says. They managed to circumvent all the difficulties, and we triumphed in the end. Houston took home the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her role, making her the third generation in her family to receive an Academy Award, following her father and grandfather. I'm still pinching myself, she says. As a child, I did that thing where you practice the speech in front of a mirror. I was very thrilled and flattered by the whole experience. In the years that followed, Houston, who split from Nicholson for a final time in 1990 after he fathered a child outside of their relationship with actress Rebecca Brossard, continued to gain recognition for her eccentric character roles, like that of the Grand High Witch in 1990's The Witches, and Morticia Adams in the Adams Family films from 1991 to 1993. Houston credits her ability to transcend boxes to being lucky to be on the cusp of ugly for so long, since there's no beauty without a little ugliness in there, and I have more than my share. It's fun to live a little bit in the dirty life. Her character in Towards Zero is as regal as they come, even as she performs a majority of her scenes sitting in a bed, and her spark was very much evident on set. There's mischief through her, and she still has a great twinkle in her eye, says Houston's co-star Matthew Rice. When I was around her, I just tried to be on best behavior and not say anything stupid and embarrass myself. She's part of a Hollywood dynasty that doesn't come around very often. She's lived a grand and colorful life, and Houston is continuing to keep an open mind, particularly when it comes to dating, something she's previously said she's avoided since her husband's death. I think I'm up for anything, she says, but I don't know whether it's in my future because Bob was very special and very irreplaceable, and a lot's gone on since Bob died. Houston's cancer diagnosis, she still wants to keep keep the type private, was earth-shaking. It was a big shock, she says. She chose to keep her journey out of the public eye over the past 6 years because sometimes you feel like you don't want to talk about it for the obvious reasons, she says. But there is a lot to be said for getting it out there and celebrating the fact that one's come through. Now, when the opportunity arises, I laugh and I try not to make a big deal out of things. When she got her all clear from the doctor 4 years ago, Houston, who still does routine scans, kept the celebration simple. It was a glorious day, she says. I walked in my garden and smelled the roses and thought how clever I was. Hollywood dynasty like none other. Lesson from Dad. Houston says a lasting piece of advice her late father, John, gave her is just to believe. I think anything is possible. Always on her mind. I still think about her every day, Houston says of her late mother. She and my dad both influenced our lives immeasurably. You've been listening to Angelica Houston, Love Healing After Cancer and Her Iconic Career, from People. I'm glad you joined us today for the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, and I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the interesting stories today. And please make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Have a great day and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.